things. And so can I, as a result of all this analysis, can I say anything about how we ought to organize society? And I don't necessarily, wasn't necessarily the greatest solution, but it was the best I could do. And, you know, essentially, I guess one way to think about it was to think that maybe libertarian environmentalism is like freedom of religion. And it's like like Protestantism. I come from a Protestant background, and although you might not know it at times. But so you could have a lot of different churches, and they could compete with each other, and each church can do its own thing, and it has to be protected from state interference. But if you were to translate that model to a political world, and where states are geographic, it would be kind of a model where you can do, I'm not ready to tell people what they should believe. I mean, I'd probably never be ready to tell them. And so I see that in these matters of belief, the only thing, and they are so fundamental, and people fight about them, and that we don't really like, that doesn't work very well. So we ought to let people, give them a lot of freedom to believe, but only, you know, within their own community. And so I'm willing to basically say that a community, this is a physical community, and with even its own government, can be have very wide latitude to have its own religion, if you want to call it that. But as long as you don't try to coerce other people, that would be, you know, something where we need a higher authority to make sure that doesn't happen. And the other thing is say that everybody has to be guaranteed the right of exit. So if you have a community, you can't force people to stay. And some outside power will come in and interfere if you try to do that. But beyond that, it's a fairly minimal role. But you could have a lot of theocracies. So I'm not against theocracy, but just small theocracy. I don't want big theocracy. So that's kind of the vision, but it's probably a little bit rough around the edges. But it's a start. It bears some resemblance to Robert Nozick and his idea of utopia. And, you know, he says that, well, the idea of utopia from the past, there really is no utopia because we don't know what it is. But we can have multiple utopias. And so actually, if you went back and read Anarchy, State, and Liberty, whatever, what's the last one? Liberty, yeah. Anyway, it has some resemblance to that, but I'm sort of getting there from a lot of other analysis, which is actually the heart of the book.
Okay, I have a question at the back, and just wait for the microphone, and then please, here it comes.
Lately, there's been a lot of buzz in the media about two commercials against global warming. One has it's a British video of people being executed, school children even, for opposing, for not reducing their carbon emissions. It's on YouTube. And the other one, it's called No Pressure. The other one is a photograph of a girl with a noose around her neck standing on an iceberg that's melting. Yeah. Both grievously offensive. So I'd like to know what your perspective is on that from your comments on the perspective that this is growing out of a religion or a twisted version of a religion.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there is a certain sense, maybe I'll get up in environmental religion. If you actually pursue some of the logic, you recognize that in environmentalism, what's basically good is natural and bad or evil is unnatural. But in environmentalism, people are unnatural. And so that means that people are evil. And so if you pursue this logic, it actually leads fairly directly, and I'm not by any means or even close to the first person to point this out. William Cronin, who might even consider himself an environmentalist, has made the point along 15 years ago that there's a certain perversity to thinking that human beings are unnatural, but then defining good as natural. But you also find in environmentalism, like David Brower, he's one of my favorite people to quote, but also Dave Foreman, they both have said human beings are the cancer of the earth. And Tom Watson, who was a founder of Greenpeace, modified it slightly and said human beings are the AIDS of the earth. So now you might say this is extreme, and of course it is. And of course any sensible environmentalist would know, even if these people were sensible, and they've already retracted it, as I understand it. But there is a logic to it, that actually you can get to the conclusion that the world would, the new utopia, if it's not a people utopia, is actually a world without people. And there's actually books now, you know, popular books. It's the new utopian literature.
Well, you know about the voluntary human experiment.
A world without people. I think that's the title of the book.
Well, there's an organization out of Oregon, the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement.
Yeah, no, they're...
I thought their bumper sticker should be you first.
Right. Yeah, well, no, I mean, the moderates in this movement say that it will be done by just voluntary abstinence from having children. And so in 100 years, we'll reach our goal. But anyway, so there is a certain sense... The thing about it is that the assumptions that get you there are embedded in mainstream environmental thinking. Now, of course, they never pursue them to that level, and they wouldn't believe it. They'd be actually somewhat distressed, I'm sure, if they actually came to accept my analysis, which is that their implicit assumptions lead to that conclusion. If you actually are a philosopher and you rigorously follow the line of the where those assumptions go. I think most environmentalists I know are actually pretty nice people, to tell you the truth.
Just a one-sentence observation on that. I've often said that the problem with environmentalists is that, and the left generally, is they don't have a sense of humor. And the no-pressure ad proved that the problem is worse than we thought.
Thank you very much. I found all the comments very interesting. I have not read the book, but this morning I read an article in the Wall Street Journal. It was quite interesting on these 24 new dams they're going to put in the Amazon tributaries in Brazil. I've lived 5 years in Brazil. In the 60s and 70s, they built huge dams with a lot of ecological damage and at the same time produced a lot of power. Well, it's a very poor country. They need power. The environmentalists don't like the other forms of power. I don't know what I mean, except for, I suppose, wind and things like that that don't make too much economic sense. In this case, the builders made dams that are smaller and have a different type of turbine to get more power out of it. The environmentalists have sort of opposed it, but have been almost defeated by the fact that these are not such egregious violations of the environment. So my question to you is, and I could go on to more of the details, maybe I haven't given enough, but is that represent a compromise between the economic religion and the environmental religion, what they are trying to do with these new dams?
I mean, I'll take this opportunity also to respond to something that Steve said, which is that environmentalism is changing. And I think my critique is really most appropriately directed at the environmental movement from, let's say, about 1970 to 1995-2000. A lot of environmentalists are... partly it's because of climate change. You just can't play in the climate change debate without becoming somewhat pragmatic and looking at energy systems and all these other things. And I actually noticed this with my students. I teach environmental policy at the University of Maryland. And I think the students that I'm getting right now, they're all basically coming out of the environmental cause, but they're more pragmatic they're moral, as you were just suggesting. And a lot of it does, they're getting into questions of, okay, how do we organize society as a way, you know, in terms of the energy systems and everything else. But for the problem the environmental movement faces is that to the extent they get into these, they don't really have anything much to offer. They're not particularly good at it, at analyzing these questions. And the contribution that they made in the past was this sort of unique moral vision. And it was easy for environmentalists to have their vision and have their policy advocacy when what they were advocating was more wilderness areas. I mean, that was a direct reflection of what they believed. It didn't fit at all with economic religion. But if you're talking about energy, I mean, both of them, you know, they actually start getting closer together on more common ground because we have to. So I don't know. I mean, I actually do think that the environmental movement itself is in a transitional stage. But I do think that criticisms such as the ones that I make in this book have played a modest, maybe more by other people who have gotten more visibility, but have played at least a modest role. I think more environmentalists now are aware, some of them, the honest ones, are aware of some of these, you know, difficulties and the fact that some of their thinking leads to these theological dead ends and so forth. And so they're trying to work something out. And I don't know how it's going to play out.
So I'm a big fan of Stuart Brand's book, which is called The Eco-Pragmatist. And that's a new book, so it's very good. But a question back here.
Yes, John Berlaw of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and author of Eco-Freaks. It's good to see you, Bob. Your lecture's enlightening as always. Was wondering if you and others on the panel could speak on the racism expressed historically by prominent environmental leaders. For instance, Paul Ehrlich advocating and never taking back that all Indian males be sterilized after their third child is born. Charles Worcester, the co-founder of Environmental Defense Fund, allegedly saying that we don't have to worry about the side effects of the ban on DDT because it will only affect harmfully his quote, Mexicans and Negroes. And going back to John Muir, when he was calling, you know, American Indians, Native Americans, ugly and a blight on the land. So with all the focus on the racism supposedly in the Tea Party, I'm wondering if they're looking for racism in the wrong movement. And it seems to me that this could have some real policy effect, because if you don't want a new housing development near you that has blacks and Latinos, you can't express that openly, but you join an environmental movement that says, oh, we can't have this because this is urban sprawl and we need smart growth, and it has the same effect of blocking housing for the poor blacks and Latinos. So if anyone could speak on that.
I will say one thing about it, and I don't actually think that it's a very small number of environmentalists who are overtly racist in the, you know, with respect to black, few maybe. But yeah, some of their solutions, like population, you know, in Ehrlich and population control, I think Garrett Hardin and other people, I mean, basically they thought that we had to impose coercive measures, but not just on races, I mean, just on the whole world. But there is an element of racism that I've actually written about in the book and in multiple times. And that has to do with the idea of wilderness and the idea that when we go into wilderness, we're going into an area which is untouched by human hand. And it turns out that most areas in the world have actually been touched by human hand, by Native Indians or Native Americans. They burned and they hunted and they did a lot of things, and they may have even, you know, wiped out the megafauna. And so this whole vision that environmentalism offers of nature untouched by human hand, actually it dismisses the whole presence of Native people who massively altered many of their environments. And so as a fantasy, I mean, you could say, well, what are they doing? I mean, they either don't know anything about the reality of what happened out there, which might be true in some cases, or they're implicitly dismissing the humanity of these native people and saying, well, even if they did change it, they don't count. And they're different, or, you know, they're not corrupt or something. But anyway, it's putting them in a whole different category from European people. And when so it's really only European people who can actually go out and alter the landscape and thereby efface or erase God's creation. And there is a strong implicit racist element in that way of looking at things. But as I say, it's not really, I wouldn't say it's racist against black people. It's racist in the treatment of any native population, basically.
Yeah, I'll offer a comment that, I think it is mostly, not wholly, but mostly a mistake to traffic in those dreadful and embarrassing quotes of those guys, mostly because they're a bunch of has-beens. I know they're all still alive, but I think it's better to talk about the distributional aspects of environmental policy as they play out in the real world, which can be race, which is race neutral on the surface. But I mean, I'll give you one example. I mean, 10 years ago when I was still living in California, and the state was still growing then, but you know, California had some of the worst regulatory structures, making new housing more expensive, which meant it disproportionately affected the Latino minority in the state. And so I said one day at a forum, you know, some environmentalists, that, you know, smart growth could be made out to stand for send Mexicans across the river tomorrow. And they went berserk. I mean, you absolutely could not say that. How dare you say something like that? I said, well, then, you know, tell me why I'm wrong about the distributional effects of your policy. And then they get incoherent, of course. You know, I mean, I've debated Ehrlich. He's a has-been, I think. I think it's much better when you're talking to him rather than say, you know, what about this stupid thing you said 40 years ago, which, by the way, I've gotten to acknowledge a couple of times while bringing him up that he was wrong about. But I'll say, what about your Malthusian methodology? How can you defend that today, and why do you still think you are right today and just wrong in your timing? I think that works a whole lot better. I mean, once in a while, those guys may deserve it, but... You know, just as, you know, I cry foul when people bring up something stupid Trent Lott said 20 or 30 years ago, I think we ought to be a little restrained in how we retail some of that stuff. Just my opinion. No.
I mean, that's where our set goes wrong. We never question motive. We always assume they must be signed and pure, and they always, and they never stop questioning our motive.
Yeah, but you know, I mean... you know, I think the guy's had his comeuppance. I mean, they say he's a has-been. I think he's a bit of a laughingstock, even among many environmentalists. By the way, you know how the wheel turns. Do you know the Matthew Connelly book, Fatal Misconception? It's a history of the population control movement from Harvard University Press by a liberal historian at Columbia, and it's absolutely scathing of Planned Parenthood International. That's by mainstream academia. It came out about 2 years ago. I mean, there's nothing left of these people at the end of that book. And that's why I say that in the end of the day, usually, you know, that's why I have some confidence in science, you know, the truth wins out on these things. And so I didn't say you're wholly wrong. I just say you want to be careful about that, I think, and judicious about it. That's all.
So we have, okay, go ahead.
Am I on?
Yep.
I think your question reveals something that we need to mention. If you're going to talk about religion, or especially a theological approach to religious, secular or sacred religious traditions, and that is that the Judeo-Christian tradition is deeply interested in justice, and that the ecological and some of the economists are also interested in justice, but it's not constitutional in their presuppositions. Whereas the Judeo-Christian tradition may have disputes about the nature and character of justice and what is fair, what is righteous, and what who's included and so forth. But it's not generally a part of the discussion as I've read it in the ecologists and in the mainline economists who adhere to the religions that Bob has outlined.
Okay, and with that, if you'll join with me in thanking all of our speakers today. Thank you all for coming.